Welcome back to Off the Hour on CKUT 90.3 FM. Today is April 22nd, a day that's popularly celebrated as Earth Day. But what does that mean? And has a day that purports to celebrate the environment been co-opted into a corporate celebration of greenwashing? To talk about Earth Day and what it means, we're joined live by phone by Amanda Lickers, Indigenous media activist. Amanda, thanks for joining us.
Bago, hi there.
Hi. So let's talk about the origins of Earth Day kind of as a phenomenon. It actually started as a part of a government initiative in the States in the 1970s after there was kind of a public outcry over pollution and it reached a breaking point. So I was wondering if you think that given its origins that weren't necessarily very grassroots, do you think it's surprising that it's become so corporatized today?
Not at all. I mean, I think that it goes to show it's part of a larger issue, right? Where concern for the environment becomes this compartmentalized thing that gets like a special day, and then we can like turn off our lights for an hour and like say that we're reducing our impact on the environment, and like look, it's possible, but like really, it's just about distracting and like short-term band-aid, like feel good. And sometimes not even solutions. So I think it's hardly surprising whatsoever. I mean, usually when there's like a mass movement for some kind of change, some kind of systemic change, or something as deep as climate change, for the entities who are actually perpetuating that violence of environmental racism, of resource extraction, and considering the United States economy is, you know, it is the U.S. dollar is a dollar that we trade oil and gas in, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a direct connection between capital gain and the government and oil and the oil industry and fossil fuels. So understanding that, like, first of all, this is stolen land, and the current ongoing occupation of indigenous territories means the exploitation of Mother Earth. And so, like, that entire relationship of capitalism, what it does to our value systems is it changes it into a monetary value system when, like, from an indigenous perspective, our value system is really like life, you know. So we understand Mother Earth as part of our family, and she's not a resource to be commodified or extracted. And so I think that it's just symptomatic of the ways in which capitalism and colonialism in the West have served to basically commodify anything that we identify as a need or an interest and wrap it up in a nice little segregated box so that way it's safe and palatable and continues the overall project of consumerism and resource extraction.
Mm-hmm. And so you alluded a bit to this, but why do you think it is that often First Nations and Native groups are on the front lines of environmental struggles? And do you see those two struggles as being inextricably intertwined?
Well, of course, I see them as being inextricably intertwined. I mean, a lot of, you know, like we talk about, for instance, like I belong to a turtle clan of the Onondaga Haudenosaunee, and Onondaga means people of the Great Hill, Haudenosaunee building the longhouse. And so my identity as an indigenous woman is directly tied to my territories, but like we're people from this particular hill, right? And that, you know, there's these areas that we consider like all of the natural world is sacred, but there's these areas that have particular significance.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, with an indigenous worldview, we are the land, you know,
mm-hmm.
and especially water as, you know, the thing that continues life. It's very important, especially our relationship as women to water, and like how as women we hold particular governance like roles within a traditional governance system, and our clan carriers and the holders of the land. And so everything tied with sovereignty and nationhood has everything to do with the women as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, especially in matrilinear societies, not all indigenous governance systems are the same, but so from that perspective, of course they're inextricably intertwined.
Mm-hmm.
When we understand that we are the land, violence on the land is violence on us. And so that's, you know, that's my friend Suzanne Palace from the Mi'kmaq Warrior Society. She refers to it as ecogenocide, destroying that which sustains us. And so when we see that, first of all, when we understand that Canada is a colonial project And the purpose of the Colonial Project is to gain access to indigenous territories and resources that would be perceived to be there, then it's no surprise that it's often indigenous folks who are living fence line to extractive projects, like whether it's tar sands mining or tar sands refinery. You know, the Ring of Fire, there's like, you know, Grassy Narrows logging. There's so many different examples where it's indigenous people who are on the front line. And even in an urban context, it's usually folks of color who live closest to refineries. And so it's really important to understand the context of environmental violence or environmental racism and the way that that plays out, which is where there's people of color and indigenous folks who are disproportionately impacted by the health effects of resource extraction or refining. And so it's pretty deeply tied into have like a nice little green bow, bow over Earth Day and say, have a couple of press conferences, have a few media stunts, and have this completely compartmentalized day where we can say, you know what, we're a progressive society and we care about the environment. We're doing these minimal things on this one day to commemorate, you know, and it's just, it's not real meaningful practice. It's not everyday struggle or systemic change. It's a meaningful, it's a symbolic rally, and it's just an opportunity to actually. A lot of the time people talk about this as diffusion, where like what happens is there becomes this mainstream opportunity for people to have a place to voice their concerns and feel heard. And that actually takes away from any kind of confrontational grassroots response to those types of things. People feel like, oh, we have solutions to climate change because we have Earth Day. And isn't that enough for the environmentalists? And without realizing that the Colonial Project is one of destroying the natural world. And if we don't have systemic structural change, then that's going to continue. It doesn't matter how many Earth Days we do every year, you know?
And can you talk a bit about what the solutions are that are, or quote unquote solutions, are that are proposed in general during Earth Day and why many see them as false solutions?
Well, I mean, a lot of the time it's just like, well, the one thing actually that I would agree with is just energy conservation and being aware of how much we're using, you know, in terms of like, do we turn lights off? I mean, sure, that's valuable. We need to be aware of how much we're consuming, especially as, you know, people in the West who are the primary consumers of like the world's energy supply.
Mm-hmm.
But thinking about, and then sometimes even there's this move towards like alternative energy, or like we can just maybe submit like this bill through the legislature that's going to like have a better, you know, taking better care of the Great Lakes or something like this. But all the solutions that are proposed usually rely on the maintenance of capitalism and the maintenance of the colonial state. And so because they're proposed within this paradigm, they're fundamentally going to fall short because they don't address any of the actual on the ground issues. When you have, you know, for instance, to use the case of the Unist'ot and the Wet'suwet'en Nation, they have said their band council, the tribal council of the Wet'suwet'en First Nation has said no to all these different pipelines, particularly the Enbridge Northern Gateway. And then you have their traditional governance, their hereditary chief, and their clan system, their clan of the Unist'ot'en clan, coming back to their traditional territories and actually setting up pit houses, which is the way that, you know, their traditional living spaces, and saying no to all pipelines. And they're taking back their territory. They're reoccupying their territory, fulfilling their ancestral responsibilities. And industry wants to push through, and the state wants to push through. And despite the fact that there's a clear, resounding no, that there's been no consultation, that there is no consent, and there's no desire for pipelines, this project still gets to be pushed forward. And it can be framed as, oh, we just need energy security within Canada, or how are we going to continue this civilization? And like all these kinds of questions come up. But the fundamental difference is that it requires the occupation of indigenous territories, the exploitation of Mother Earth in order to continue living in this way. And so, you know, there's this fundamental disconnect between the perceived goals of Earth Day of like raising awareness about the environment and trying to like make some positive changes, without understanding the systemic aspects of it and the very intentional project of land occupation and resource development.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so to go back to the idea of greenwashing, a lot of things that people will say, particularly around Earth Day, is that perhaps the solutions that are being proposed aren't enough, but that it's better than nothing, that kind of this idea that companies should be more green, that that's better than if, for example, the companies didn't have this motivation to be quote unquote green. And I was wondering, how would you respond to that, this idea that even though Earth Day might have its problems, at least it's raising awareness, at least it's pushing companies to give the appearance of being more environmentally friendly?
Well, I think in a way you just hit it there with the notion of appearances, right? Because we can have this commemorative day. We can say, oh, it's good that companies are able to use corporate social responsibility or public relations and media and have a few public stunts to appear more green. But what are they actually doing on the ground? How often do they report their releases? Who do they report them to? Does the community get notified? Like, how can we actually hold these corporations responsible to any kind of agreement that they make? You know, there is complete impunity on behalf of corporations to be able to just poison at will the environment. And there is no capacity within the Canadian state, whether it's the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission or the National Energy Board, as federal regulatory bodies, to actually oversee these processes in a meaningful way and ensure that community consultation and accountability on a community level, like whether it's an Indigenous or non-Indigenous community, that bills and all kinds of other releases and like long-term environmental devastation is actually dealt with. You know, how many remediation projects are being undertaken, and like on whose terms are they being undertaken? You know, so I think you know, again, it's this understanding that if we just have this one day, then all the problems go away. But we need to take it a lot, like many steps further, and understand, like, first of all, we can't live without clean water. We can't live without clean air. And it is a natural world that provides those things to us. And so, again, from an Indigenous perspective, the idea of celebrating the earth is something that should be part of your everyday lifestyle. You know, that should be part of your basic core values. Mm-hmm. And so, again, with that compartmentalization, it's almost like it's okay to do a spill here or try to or have an open pit mind there, but if we just like make sure that there it's under certain parts per millions of emission per year, that doesn't have a cumulative impact on an ecosystem or a community. You know, what are we doing long term to especially when you look at fracking, you know, and the issue of water, like what are you doing to the water tables? Mm-hmm. How can you greenwash the poisoning of a water table? Like that's your basic water source. You know, and so there's a lot of this work is it almost gives into the idea with this greenwashing, with this phenomenon of greenwashing, that there's a small amount of damage that's okay, but right. at what point do you have an acceptable risk or collateral damage? You know, like how do you make those differentials, and who is experiencing those impacts? You know, because it's not going to be the CEOs of Shell or the CEOs of TransCanada who are going to be at the brunt of, you know, of like, for instance, tar sands mining, right? It's communities, right. And it's also workers, mm-hmm. who are directly impacted. And yeah.
Well, we're actually out of time, but Amanda Lickers, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks very much for your call.
We've been speaking to Indigenous media activist Amanda Lickers about Earth Day and the problems with the rhetoric that generally surrounds it.